Peter Buffett in the studio with us today. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Beautiful day. Beautiful time to be here.
Yeah. I mean, it's autumn full on, isn't it?
It is. It is.
And compelling t-shirt you're wearing today.
Thank you so much. Doesn't it look great on the radio? It's really too bad people can't see it, but what it says is decolonizer.
Just a nice gray t-shirt with one word
one
in black
word
across your chest.
Kind of says it all.
We meet on Tuesday afternoons for the Surviving the Future Tuesday Afternoon Book Club. Chelsea Green and Sean Chamberlain, who edited this book from the writings of David Fleming, have given us permission to air chapters of the audiobook, and we've been doing that for a bunch of weeks now. If you want to get caught up on what's happened so far, you can go to the archive at RadioKingston.org. Man, I'm just loving this. I'm loving this book, which I've read, but hearing it in this format, I'm loving discussing it with you.
Yeah, I mean, so grateful that they're letting us do this and that the station can do these kinds of things. I mean, it's not every radio station that can just make a choice and say, hey, you know what? People need to hear this. Let's put it out.
Without a doubt. And that's the beauty of being this kind of community radio station is that we're not worried that that we have, people are going to tune out because it's too long or it's too that. It's
you're going to lose an advertiser.
Right.
Yeah.
None of that.
None of that.
So we're greatly fortunate to do that. We've heard the editor's preface so far, the introduction, a foreword. We've heard the first three chapters, which comprises part one, which has the heading A Framework for Community. And for the next 22 minutes or so, we're going to listen to the beginning of part two. And here's Sean Chamberlain, who reads the book so beautifully, to tell you more about that.
Part two, rediscovering a life of place and play. Chapter four, Carnival. Celebrations of music, dance, torchlight, mime, games, feast and folly have been central to the life of community for all times other than those when the pretensions of large-scale civilization descended like a frost on public joy. Carnival is a big word. It spans the buffoonery of the feasts of fools, the erotic Saturnalia of Rome, the holy holidays of the church's calendar in the agricultural year, and local days of festival in which communities, for most of history, have put down their work and concentrated on enjoying themselves. The making and sustaining of community requires deep engagement and empowerment with three key properties. One, the radical break. This is the community's break from the normality of the working day, a change of key, the opportunity to see things from a different point of view, to be enchanted. The word that summarizes this best is ecstasy, from the Greek ekstasis, standing outside oneself. Conventions are broken, there is good order being turned upside down, and the stepping briefly over the edge of chaos, before, slightly changed and refreshed, stepping back into regular life. The reminder that normal good behavior is not a habit, but a matter of choice, for now. Two. Second nature. This is the animal spirit at the heart of the tamed, domesticated citizen. The deep reality which, if recognized and cared for, connects us with the red-blooded truth about ourselves. And three, sacrifice and succession, which affirms the ability of the community to survive, to be immortal, in spite of, or because of, the death of other communities and, eventually, of its own living members. The death of individuals in the community is overcome by birth and renewal, and the failure of some communities may be essential for the survival of the system as a whole. In a day of magic and colour, Carnival enables, declares and celebrates these encounters with the nature of our situation, ourselves and our community. It is the central event of community building at the scale of the town, as we shall now explore. Carnival, uses and origins. Carnival is, first of all, a form of ritual. Like all rituals, it is a performative utterance which makes something happen, points to spiritual depth and complexity, establishes or confirms the identity, even the existence, of a community or institution, and gives recognition to the implicit functions and reciprocal obligations which make up the fabric of social order. The power of ritual as an effective means of sustaining societal structures was illustrated on a grand scale in the imagination of Plato. In his Republic, goods are shared out amongst all members of the guardian class, an arrangement which would require highly developed altruism and commitment to the common good. But in his City of the Magnesians, he went even further. Here, goods would be shared amongst all citizens. And the problem was, of course, to find ways of making this exceptionally ambitious and unstable social ethic hold up. His solution to the problem was to design the city's culture around the ceaseless performance of ritual. Every day of the year had its own festival, binding the city together in a rhythmic pattern, integrating the gods into the enterprise. The citizens, as Catherine Pickstock writes, were strung together on a thread of song and dance. The performance of ritual constantly renewed the commitment to the fragile ethic of common property. The City of the Magnesians is fiction, but Plato accepted, as a fact of life, that shared ritual is crucial for the delivery of social cohesion. There is, in Carnival, a quality of exuberance which distinguishes it from the sedate proceedings which we would usually understand by the word ritual, but it possesses, nonetheless, ritual's seven properties. 1. Membership. Ritual is a regular meeting place, and taking part in it affirms that the participants are members of the community. Communities need to have some reason for getting together. If that reason is a myth with no practical function, nothing is lost. What matters is the getting together. In Carnival, the sense of membership is often deepened by dance, once a central expression of the religions, including Christianity. Dance is synchronized, interactive, and requires people to engage with, and sometimes even to touch, each other. It is also both active and passive, or perhaps somewhere in between. There is a sense of being willingly swept up in doing something dramatic and beautiful, without having to make decisions about it. For the resilient communities of the past, dance was no mere entertainment. It was a key expression of membership. 2. Emotional daring. The way emotion multiplies when shared is poignantly illustrated in a reflection by the French historian Jules Michelet, who as a child was kept away from the carnival. "My childhood never blossomed in the open air, in the warm atmosphere of an amiable crowd, where the emotion of each individual is increased 100-fold by the emotion felt by all." When a group shares an emotion with you, it is likely that you will be able to feel it with more intensity and insight, or at least with more confidence than you could alone. Personal joys and sorrows are placed within the context of collective joys and sorrows. You can feel emotionally uplifted by the exultant music of the Messiah or the Great Harvest Psalm. Strong bonds can be built up in a community that is encountered at such depth. A community which not only feels the same emotion as you do, but enhances it, is a community you feel you can trust. And there is an ecstatic quality about being happy among other happy people. It sometimes happens when playing in the snow. 3. Continuity. The unchanging quality of ritual bears out beliefs and hopes about the permanence of the community. The same music, dance, and choreography, the way we do it here, handed down between generations and evolving slowly, if at all. It is a symbol of continuity, a stable code for the community. As the anthropologist Maurice Bloch notes, the ritual locates a particular social order in its setting as a fact of the nature of the world. This differentiates it from the daily schemes and politics of the moment. Its presence is real, dependable, reassuring. It is there on its own terms. It is something to which an individual can defer. The shaman or priest in the early religions who changed the ritual or liturgy broke the spell. and would be in trouble, perhaps at risk of his life. The rules and practices confer timeless legitimacy on the community. It has the courage of its conventions. 4. Consciousness of time and events. The progression of the year and events in the community and in the lives of its members are noticed and affirmed by ritual and rites of passage. The event is marked. It takes place in the mind as well as in the environment. Ritual celebrates the stories and events that made the community, acknowledging seasons and accomplished tasks, renewing members' awareness of their community's history and of the stories and traditions which give it identity. Once local saints and heroes were remembered, the agricultural year was celebrated, rites of passage, baptism, adulthood, marriage, death were observed. A young man would be made explicitly conscious of becoming a full member of the community and of the responsibilities and duties that conferred. Ritual was the performative utterance that turned events into the building blocks of a culture. As James Roos Evans comments on the barely visible remnant of these rites of passage, no wonder we undergo identity crises until we die. 5. Practice. Practical skills required by carnival demand, and thus build, craftsmanship. Ritual requires talent, music, speech, building and decoration, often along with dance, acting and dressmaking, cooking, games, wrestling, organisation and stage management. Such craftsmanship in turn cultivates other skills. First, truthfulness. The craft itself will not allow you to bluff your way through, and it will be necessary to sustain a truthful relationship with the people from whose example or teaching you are learning. Secondly, fairness. The craft will require you to be fair in your judgment of yourself and others in the performance of the skill. And thirdly, courage. You will need to have the courage from time to time to attempt something beyond your present capacity, to make sacrifices, to take risks, and to persist despite criticism and setbacks. These virtues are the very skills that build citizenship. 6. Meaning. Ritual does not supply answers. It suggests insights and raises contradictions to be explored, to grow into through a lifetime. Its characteristic medium is narrative truth, the artistic, poetic, performative truth, with the power to raise questions which reward long reflection. If not with literal answers, then perhaps with the gradual deepening of the questioner, who is free to reach and live by his own conclusions. And 7, locality. Ritual marks the community's residence in a place. It puts down emotional roots and changes the nature of the place a little bit, making it special. Because the ritual has happened there, you will think about it in a different way for the rest of your life, like a tree under which you once made love, and which you still pass with musing nostalgia from time to time. Ritual events make places, bring them alive, haunt them or bless them, populate them with the spirit of what happened, so that today's inhabitants are not alone. And when ritual takes the form of carnival, local diversity goes to imaginative extremes. York's signature carnival was the lavish display of Corpus Christi. Dunmow's famous flitch of bacon is awarded to the married couple who had lived together for a year without quarrel or regret. In Orkney, carnival was organised around a ploughing competition, in which the farmers were young boys and the horses were young girls. Cider-growing areas took care to have carnivals near their apple trees and to pour cider on their roots to make them feel appreciated. Ritual is not just any ritual, it is yours, because this is the ritual which you help to make with the people you live amongst, in the place where you live. In the past, there were, in addition, two substantial assets that were brought to community by the ritual of carnival. 8. Social rank on hold. For the duration of the carnival, at least, social rank became less important, and hard to sustain with due seriousness. The carnival created its own temporary, unofficial, popular aristocracy. Rank, privilege, received common sense, and norms were suspended. Carnival was always, in a sense, the feast of fools, in which the powerful, the pompous, the monstrous, outrageous, and some of the frightening aspects of society could be laughed at and made safe. A marketplace full of laughing people is hard to impress. Laughter upstages rank. And ecstasy upstages rank, too. It need not be ecstasy of a kind to be wary of. It can be the spectacular dancing joy we encounter in, for instance, Bach's Freue dich, in his Cantata No. 30. Music with its own precedence and authority. Unconstrained joy is an equalizer. As the historian of carnival, Barbara Ehrenreich, notes, it's difficult, if not impossible, to retain one's regal dignity in the mad excitement of the dance. 9. Peace. Carnival is a promoter of peace. The lack of discipline and hierarchy make carnival a poor foundation on which to build an army. Other incentives to fight, such as attack by neighbors, may brush aside carnival's preference for peace, but it's still a property of some value. Carnival does not need the further excitement of war. Carnival persons. The sources of carnival belong to the later history of apes as much as to the early history of humans. But here are two persons, people doesn't seem to be quite the right word here, who hold a place of honour in its evolution. The first is Dionysus, the Greek god of wine and ecstasy. Dionysus had a difficult start in life. Zeus, a god, was married to Hera, a goddess, but made Semele, a mortal, pregnant. When Hera found out about this, she arranged for Semele to be consumed by Zeus's own lightning. But Zeus managed to rescue the fetus from the ashes and plant it in his thigh, from which in due time the young Dionysus was born. He was immediately torn to shreds on Hera's instructions, but, providentially, his grandmother, Harmonia, was on hand to put him together again. The infant Dionysus was then to be looked after by his aunt, but this came to grief when Hera condemned her to madness, whereupon she jumped into the sea and became a sea goddess. Finally, Dionysus was brought up by the nymphs of Mount Nysa, where his divinity became manifest. And before long he was travelling and preaching the virtues of wine, ecstasy, and peace. He attracted disciples, men and women who spent their days possessed, intoxicated, and dancing. But this too brought trouble, for the undisciplined band provided little protection against robbers, and Dionysus was kidnapped by pirates and tied to the mast. Fortunately, he was able to command the bonds to fall off him, and a vine to grow about the mast in their place. He himself turned briefly into a lion, and the alarmed sailors jumped overboard and turned into dolphins. We are not told how the ship got back to port, but evidently it did so, for Dionysus had a long and varied career ahead of him. Dionysus was remarkable, even by the standards of a god. Whereas other gods merely existed, Dionysus could be brought into being by dance. Here was a dance god that demanded no sacrifices, but existed for the joy of the dance itself. And these were qualities which made him popular with women who, at a signal, would put down their spinning and rush off into the mountains to dance in his honour, toss their hair, drink wine and, though this bit, omophagia, may be just a wicked rumour put about by men, eat wild animals raw. One day, the poet Edmund Spenser's Elfin Knight actually came across a group of women in the midst of their Dionysian dance, and he could hardly believe his eyes. 100 naked maidens lily white, all ranged in a ring and dancing in delight. The second significant person in the story of carnival and dance is Jesus. And, as Barbara Ehrenreich shows, the two had much in common. Both had a father god and a mortal mother, enjoyed wine and meat, were healers, were popular with women but, it seems, had no sexual partners, were lovers of peace, defended the poor, turned water into wine, were dismissive of the citizen virtues of work and planning ahead, and were worshipped with ecstatic dance, which could bring people to a state of the deepest communion and bliss. Indeed, it is a matter of some doubt whether Dionysus and Jesus can really be regarded as two persons at all, rather than as two representatives among many, Pan, Savasio, Osiris, of a deep and sustained consciousness of our second nature, ecstatic participation in the natural world, the sacrificial gift, spontaneity. All remembered dimly, despite being overlaid by civic responsibility, by the need to be sensible, to calculate, to plan strategy, to look about warily. Our second nature is comfortable with, and secretly delights in, levitation from the laws of physics and economics, with enchanted logic taking us into the world of anti-reality and dream. It is hard to get at. It is not a matter to be talked about, but it can be danced. Stepping out. The natural form taken by ritual is dance, and of course the music that goes with it. In the earliest centuries of Christianity, it was a danced religion, and evidently the dance could get wild. It included, for instance, hair tossing, which, according to accounts from various times and places, has been one of the recurring actions of wild dance. Women's ecstatic tossing of their long hair could sometimes make it crack like a whip. St. Paul's famous injunction that women should either keep their head covered or at least keep their hair short may have been intended to discourage what he saw as these excesses. The woman ought to have power on her head because of the angels. And that anxious plea that the ecstatic worshippers should cool it set the theme for a standoff between the church hierarchy, which advocated decorum, and the worshippers, who preferred ecstasy, which has shaped the development of both carnival and churches ever since. In broad terms, music and dance are forms of extravagance, and extravagance was a virtue defended by Jesus. He approved of wine and feasting. When the woman came to him with an alabaster box of precious ointment and anointed his feet with it, prompting indignant protests from the disciples who said that it would have been better to sell it and give the money to the poor, Jesus' reply was withering. And it happened again in his reply to Martha's complaint about being cumbered about with much serving in the kitchen, while his sister Mary sat in conversation with their guest. Martha, Martha, thou art careful and trouble about many things, but one thing is needful, and Mary has chosen that good part, which shall not be taken away from her. But churches increasingly began to see the bottom-up creativity of music and dance as the wrong kind of exuberance. And around the early 13th century, the long-held priestly assumption that the church ought to be above spontaneous joy began at last to take effect. So, carnival had to move outside, to the churchyard, the street, the village green. This was a major source of complaint, and Francois Rabelais' story of what happened to the sacristan, who would not let a villager borrow some priestly robes for him to wear in a play in which he had been cast as God, tells us something about how deep this ran. The villagers, armed with saucepans and sticks, ambushed the sacristan on his horse, so that the horse bolted. The sacristan fell off but caught his foot in the stirrup. When eventually the horse was caught, there was nothing left of him but the stump of his foot. Villagers were evidently short of patience with people of the priestly persuasion who wanted to throw them out of the best building in the place and spoil their fun. The expulsion of carnival from the churches had, however, its good, if unintended, consequences. Carnival became extraordinarily developed, with dance, decoration, and invention happening throughout the year, especially those parts of the year when less work was needed in the fields. We hear a lot about the hardships of the Middle Ages, the famines, plagues, and wars. All true. What we find harder to believe, since it violates our right to feel smug about the wonders of modernity, is that the Middle Ages were also a time of inventive joy, an age of art, participation, and festivals. All of which, as the historian E.P. Thompson notes, were, in an important sense, what men and women lived for.
That's part the first half of chapter 4 called Carnival from Surviving the Future, as we continue the Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future book club. It's Radio Kingston, 1490 WKNY, Kingston, New York. Now that we got the legality out of the way, Peter Buffett, boy, you know?
Music, dance, spontaneity. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and it's interesting to hear, you know, the description of how bottom-up celebration, bottom-up reveling is a threat to authority.
Yeah, exactly. And we live in this time now where we have very specific holidays that everyone acknowledges on the same day throughout the country. And the meaning is lost with, if not all of them, a lot of them. I mean, yes, Memorial Day has its meaning, Labor Day has its meaning, but we don't really deeply feel and know. I mean, some of us do have potentially, you know, lost someone in the armed services or something on Memorial Day, but generally speaking, these are days off from wage labor as opposed to a celebration in the place at a moment that means something deeply to the people in that place. And so often it was around harvest time, planting, you know, the seasons, the natural world. And we're separated from that in so many ways.
I particularly also like that that celebration could be specific to a place, right?
Yeah.
So nationwide, exactly. We celebrate these things, you know, on a scale that's so huge, but we have some very specific things to our area,
right,
that we could be celebrating. Our type of harvest, for instance.
Right, the absolutely.
The extraordinary river down, yep, at the end of Broadway. There are things that could be localized to Kingston.
Yeah, that would... which I encourage everyone out there to think about, and let's figure out how to do it. And this station can help you, because even in the beginning times of talking about the station and what it could do, something I was excited about was helping really promote block parties and things like that. So people at least felt that in their neighborhood, in the place they lived, there was a somewhat spontaneous and certainly felt celebration that only could happen there with the people that you knew.
Yeah, if you have an idea for a block party coming up next season, let us know.
Yeah.
We'll help you, without a doubt. Trust, again, trust has been a topic that has come up previously in this book. And again, it comes up in the part of this chapter that we heard today. A community which not only feels the same emotion as you do, but enhances it, is a community you feel you can trust.
Yeah. Yeah, trust, I say this all the time, trust is the carbon on the periodic table of relationships. Trust is, did I just say Trump? Trust is carbon. you know, and at the same time, I will bring that up in the sense that even our highest institutions now, they are sowing distrust. They are saying, this is fake, don't believe that. And that is creating a level of, you know, wondering who to trust at our time. And you know who you can trust? The people that are around you, the people you see every day, the people you interact with. And, you know, even to the point where the financial crisis probably wouldn't have happened if you went to the school with the kids that held your mortgage. You know, I mean, you have relationships as opposed to transactions, and that changes everything.
The idea, too, that, you know, this sort of work for a purpose idea, right?
Yeah.
People wake up on a Monday morning and they go to a job that they don't necessarily like because it gives us an illusion that there's a purpose to our life. Might be a little bit overstated.
Yep. Yeah, and that's why, you know, jobs, absolutely. You know, we talk about the importance of them and, you know, the job numbers are going up and all this stuff. But what we really should be measuring, and so many times measurements are just plain wrong, we should be measuring joy. I want to see the metric for joy enter into this. And that can come through a job. They're not mutually exclusive at all. But a purposeful job is a very different thing than making a living so you can go home and spend the money on something that makes you happy or the illusion of happiness. You know, where everything feels a little upside down.
Yeah. And to that end, I wonder what if our nature was reversed? What if that equation was inverted? so that joy had more of an importance.
Right.
And the work, I mean, certainly we need to grow food. We need to build shelters. Right. But maybe if we were more inclined to build that around joy in a community, it might change things.
And I think you'd actually taste it in the food, to tell you the truth, because people would be growing food knowing they were supporting their neighbors. They would be building houses knowing that there were families being nurtured inside of them. You know, the purpose behind the work is critical, I think, to not only the person doing the work, but the outcome, you know, the home itself, the food itself. You're going to have a different feeling. I guarantee it. I mean, I'm lucky enough to eat food from the land I live on, grown by farmers I know, and I feel different because of it.
Yeah, without a doubt. I love the introduction of carnival persons. Our neighborhood has carnival people in it. They are, and some people can look askance at them, you know, thinking, you know, that they're a little untethered or whatever it is, but they're my favorite people. There's a fellow in Uptown Kingston I know, and I saw him recently, and I said, Mark, you're looking good. And he said, I must be doing something wrong.
It's so funny, because I said to Jennifer recently that I think often crazy is just imagination at work and how well it interfaces with the current culture. So in other words, a very imaginative person may look crazy, but they're just pushing the envelope of joy and self-reflection and all these various things that can happen. So, yeah.
Yeah, and if you're a carnival person, by most of what you are, and you're kind of squeezed into something else, that's not going to feel good, and that's not going to come out right.
No, and that, I think, speaks to many of our systems and institutions, especially when it relates to education, but beyond that, and why we have such a prescription drug problem and opioid crisis, because people are being wedged into places that people just don't belong in, and you start to feel like it's you, and it's actually not.
Yeah, I can say that there are certainly people in need of that sort of medication, but I think there are also people who are in need of carnival.
Right, absolutely.
Instead of a prescription.
Yeah, yeah, and I know way more 4-year-old boys than I used to, because so many, like my nephew had a child and some friends at the farm, you know, there's suddenly a plethora of 4- and 5-year-olds in my universe, and their parents are constantly frustrated with having to look at schools and line them up and sit them down and have them be quiet, when honestly, they all just want to run around outside naked.
Yeah, right. And again, that comes back to the, you know, inverting the percentages there of how much time in a day for kids that age particularly is spent having carnival, and how much is, you know, being sort of molded to fit a future life of 9 to 5.
Right, which of course is what the education system was built on. It was built on assimilation in the 19th century, and it's just outmoded. I mean, it was never correct. And of course, education is great for certain things, certain people. There's tracks to follow. I don't think we're saying bad things about any particular institution. It's how they are wielded over everybody, as opposed to the people that could really benefit from them, and how many people really don't.
It's Jimmy Buffett's Peter Buffett's our Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future book club continues next Tuesday with the second half of Chapter 4, which is titled Carnival. The book is Surviving the Future: Culture, Carnival, and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy. It's edited by Sean Chamberlain from the writings of David Fleming from a much bigger work called Lean Logic. The book itself is available locally at Rough Draft in Uptown Kingston. You can follow previous discussions, chapters that we've discussed on the air here by going to radiokingston.org and calling up the archives. You can get the audiobook too yourself. Kudos to Sean Chamberlain for not only putting together the writings for this book. He does a great job reading it, and I say that with professional with a professional eye.
Yeah, and you know, having read one book on tape, my own, or Audible book, I was told after the first day, well, I felt exhausted. I was wiped out, and I went back to the producer the next day and told him that, and he said, well, yeah, it's like you're flying to Paris on, and talking the whole time, you know, 5 hours of sitting in a chair and basically exhaling.
You can find a link to the audiobook, which is also highly recommended, by going to our Facebook page. We put a link up there to the Chelsea Green Publishing website. And again, thanks to Sean Chamberlain and Chelsea Green Publishing for allowing us to do the Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future Book Club. Mr. Buffett, I will see you next Tuesday afternoon.
See you next week.